Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. Well, this is Donna Sebo, and we have a topic that I don't know is often discussed, and it's about missing people. And so many families have had to go through the experience of dealing with this. My guest today is a woman that decided she was going to approach this, work with it, and I think Mariana Bonsack is quite a gal. Her book is titled Gone Missing in New York, and I find that the material is, much of it, can be applied in many different aspects to just about anybody, anywhere. And so I want to welcome to the show Mariana Bonsack. This is really quite a fascinating topic, Mariana. What happened?
Yes, it is.
How did you get involved in this? What was it that made you decide that this was going to be something that you really wanted to dedicate your time, your effort, your learning curve, if you will, to understanding more about?
Well, the town I grew up in, a little tiny rural town in New York State called Grahamsville, New York. And just before I was born, a 22-month-old boy, Freddie Holmes, went missing from an extremely remote farm. So I grew up kind of with his story, and by the time I was in my 40s, it was, you know, mythical proportions. So I decided I wanted to find out the real story about Freddie Holmes, and I believed I'd be writing, you know, one article. And as I started to research about missing people, I found out that it is an epidemic everywhere. So what turned out to be a story about one 22-month-old missing boy ended up being about people missing all over New York and actually everywhere, because it's a huge epidemic in this country.
Now, you did focus on New York, which to me makes sense because you can't cover everything. But I found so much of your material is really universal in theme. There are literally thousands of men, women, and children that just disappeared. And we're not talking about the people, well, maybe we are talking about the people that just decide to vanish. And they come from, you know, all kinds
really
of backgrounds.
A really small proportion, Let me scare you, because you said thousands of people. Currently missing in the United States, it's estimated that at least 10 million people are missing from the United States right now.
Oh, wait a minute. 10 million people? Where is that
roughly? That statistic comes from the FBI. Anybody can go on the FBI website. The FBI keeps public statistics about, you know, all sorts of crimes. You can find about any kind of crime. But you can find out about missing people. And roughly about a million people go missing every year. Obviously, it changes from year to year, so these are really rough figures. So roughly a million people go missing every year. About out of those million people, they may recover 900,000, which leaves a balance of 100,000 every year. So every year, we're talking about a tremendous number of people who go missing and are not located. Now, just to scare you a little further, the FBI keeps statistics only on the people that are reported to the FBI. Local police agencies are not required to report missing people to the FBI. So that's why those figures are always very, you know, very rough. In New York State alone, it averages, you know, 3 children a day go missing. I am including runaways in that figure. But it's really, it's such a huge phenomenon, and people don't even realize how many people are missing right now in the United States.
You bring out a point that, just from what you've said, that local police agencies are not required to put their information into what I call a mainframe database.
No, they might have their own little files,
but they're not connected. And
right.
You state in your book, a family in New York may never know that their loved one is in an unmarked grave in California because law enforcement agencies are not required to exchange information. And I remembered when I worked for a police department many years ago, I never could understand why the little groups, you could have like 10 different police departments within a certain radius, and they were all like, and this is, some people are not going to appreciate this, they were all like little fiefdoms. They wouldn't cooperate with each other. And I was talking with a police officer not that long ago that was saying a certain police department will absolutely not work with others, and yet there are some police departments that are very, very cooperative. Now, this is something that in our day and age, you would think that that would change, because all of this information, not just about missing people, but criminal behavior, et cetera, my goodness, this should be available to any law enforcement agency. And
yes,
this must be horrific for people.
Yeah, and I certainly don't want to bash police, because I think the vast majority of them are extremely hardworking people.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is they're not just hardworking, they're overworked. So when it comes to having to do the extra work, maybe of reporting something to the FBI or the National Database on Missing People, a lot of times it's manpower, sometimes it's ignorance, and I don't mean that in a bad way. If you went missing from an extremely rural part of anywhere in this nation, the police department may not have the experience of what to do when a person goes missing. So
they might not
even know what they should do, and by the time they find out, you know, a person could have been missing quite a long time. And that's one of the reasons why I'm pushing for a protocol that requires certain steps be taken when anyone goes missing anywhere, you know, so that every missing person, no matter who they are, gets the same treatment. It doesn't matter who your family is or how much money you have or whether the police think they're going to solve it, that everybody deserves the same search. Getting back to the numbers, though, we're talking about a tremendous amount of people who go missing. So, you know, I hate to say it all comes down to money, but I think it all comes down to money.
And, well, I think you're right.
It's really sad. Yeah.
Right. And the technology to do this kind of database, and that's another thing. I mean, how many of us have computers, but how many of us have the same stuff on our computer? You know, some people want different software, and there's budgets for that, and it does. It boils down to money. It's money, it's training, it's staff, all of that.
Awareness.
Combines together. Now, you said in 2008, this is going back a few years, 20,414 children alone go missing. Now, let's
in
talk
New York.
About this. Yeah, just in New York.
In New York.
In New York.
Yes, make that clear. And, it's not the country yet.
You know, I've been in New York, and New York is such a densely populated area, and you're just going. I mean, the pace in New York is phenomenal. Missing people, I mean, just the population density alone, somebody could be missing for weeks, and unless they had a family member that knew their time schedule, knew what they were doing, they wouldn't know they were missing.
Exactly. Exactly.
And this happened in Texas, Los Angeles, anywhere. So what do you do?
You know,
what happened?
Part of my book and part of what I go out and talk to people in the community, too, is that, you know, I think this is what you're talking about. Like, a single person could be missing for 3 weeks before somebody says, hey, you know, they didn't show up for work. But it's very important for people to let people know where they are. I have a whole chapter in my book about keeping a safe box, keeping track of each other. Because when somebody goes missing, you know, those TV shows say the first 48 hours are the most important. Well, they're right for Change TV. It is. Some people need to get in, and it's really the first 48 hours that a search needs to start. Now, the problem is sometimes even if the police are notified, that search won't start in the first 48 hours because the police will say, oh, well, maybe they're at a friend's house or they took off, you know, wanted to get away. So a lot of times some of these searches aren't even starting until critical information is already gone.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, so I used to live alone. I don't anymore, but I used to get in the habit of leaving 3x5 cards on my refrigerator of where I was going or and things like that. So if something should happen, the police, you know, wouldn't at least have a place to start. So I think that was what you were asking. I'm not sure.
Right. We need. I think that it's important, and I don't. I'm not discussing this to put the sense of terror into anybody's soul. I think it's important that we be aware of these things. Now, today, in many respects, we're fortunate. We have cell phones.
Yeah.
We have ways of communicating as long as the battery works, and there's cell phone towers in the area. But when you go back in history, and that's something that you bring out in your book, you bring out some cases, and one case was absolutely intriguing to me. It's a woman by the name of Barbara, and this was over 150 years ago. I mean, you found some very interesting cases. And
well, that one I have a personal connection to. That is my my daughter's, my ex-husband's family. That is their great-great-great-grandmother.
Amazing.
So, and she actually went disappearing from about a mile from where I live right now. And back then, it was basically... You got your friends together, you looked around the neighborhood, because there's no DNA, there was nothing then. So, you know, but I believe that every case is solvable, even that one.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one's older than that. But I do believe that that one is solvable, even after 150 years. And I'm hoping that somebody will come forward and, you know, remember a family story or something and share that with me.
You have a case.
I think most of these cases are solvable. I
mm-hmm.
think that people do know something. Unfortunately, let's face it, a lot of missing people are homicide victims, but that haven't been identified. And I do think that somebody has a bit of the missing piece, and they may not even know they have it. And we're hoping that's the purpose, actually, the purpose of the whole book. It turned into we're hoping that people will come forward and maybe, you know, give us a little piece of the puzzle of one of these cases so that the police can you know, find the person and give these families a little peace of mind because they've been suffering for a long time.
Absolutely. Now, you talk about a judge that went missing, the New York State Supreme Court Justice Joseph Force Crater. And
yes.
You state in your book that he is one of the most famous missing person cases in New York.
Yes.
What happened to him, and what was the status?
Well, you know, it's kind of strange what happened to him. He had just been recently appointed to the bench, so he was brand new. He actually even hadn't been in a courtroom yet as a judge. And... he was supposedly involved maybe with a little organized crime. And he and his wife had a house in Maine, and they had gone to the house on vacation, and supposedly while there he had received a phone call. And he told his wife he had to go home, you know, and solve some business. He'd be back in time for her birthday, which was a week away. And he never came back. And she acted a little suspiciously. She refused to come back from Maine to New York State because if she came back to New York State, she would be subject to this grand jury and would have had to answer questions because they convened mm-hmm. a grand jury because they thought perhaps a crime had been committed. So she didn't return back to New York State until the grand jury had closed their investigation. So she was never actually questioned. She went on and lived a full life. She had him declared dead 7 years later and was able to collect his insurance. But what's strange about the case, there's a couple things strange. In the 1950s, supposedly, they dug up a body that in Coney Island that they were not able to identify. And about 5 or 6 years ago, I don't have the dates in front of me, a woman in New York City died and left her family a letter that said that her brother was involved in the murder of Judge Forrest Crater, and that his body could be found in the area where this body was supposedly had been dug up. They disposed of the body. Nobody knows where it is, so they really can't prove if that was him or not. What's also interesting is at the same time that Judge Forrest Crater went missing, he was having a rumored affair with a girl named Sally Lou Ritz. Sally Lou Ritz went missing about 3 months after Judge Forrest Crater went missing, and she had never been located either. So, you know, did he run off with his lover? Was he murdered? I mean, nobody's really sure what happened, but there's been sightings of Judge Forrest, he's long lost dead, I'm sure. There's been sightings of him all over the world. So it's still in New York. If you're a New Yorker, if you pull a Crater, it means you disappear. So, it's a very complex case. I only touched the little bits of it. I mean, there's also, he left a note to his wife that some people interpreted as a suicide note. So did he commit suicide? Did he run off with his girlfriend? Was he murdered by the mob? Nobody's really sure what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yes, it is. And the different time frames. I think so many people, when they're watching these various shows on television like Cold Case and CSI and all of this other, it gives the appearance that, boy, things can really be looked at and worked with and within a very short period of time resolved. And that's far from reality. Forensic medicine is not, we don't have that many skilled people in the area of forensic medicine like it's portrayed on television. And good detective work, from anybody I've known in the business, it takes time. Once in a while they get lucky, but usually you have to really dig.
You have to dig, and if there is no evidence, particularly no evidence of a crime, the police are really limited in what they can do. I mean, if I disappeared and they came in my house and they can't find any evidence of where I might have gone, what evidence do they have to work with to find me? You know, it really, unfortunately, a lot of these cases, it's literally like the person was just scooped up off the planet. And they have some suggestions of what might have happened, but suggestions aren't proof. You know, if a man or woman was having an affair, that's not proof that somebody killed them, you know. So it's, you know, if you don't have anything to work with, these shows always seem like, oh, yeah, they find that, you know, significant hair. The truth is a lot of these people just go out shopping one day and never come back. I think of, there are some women in the Albany area who are, Audrey Heron has been missing from Catskill, New York, for about 20 years now. She's missing with her car. So they don't even have, you know, they didn't even find her car. Kelly Sue Akernex, who's missing from Johnstown, New York, her car was found on fire. So if there had been any evidence in the car, it's gone. So the police don't have evidence. You know, it's great if they do, but in many of these cases, they don't have anything to work with. And like in my case, I've never been arrested. I've never given DNA, though as a teacher, I have given fingerprints. If they find a body somewhere else and they run the DNA through a data bank, I'm not going to come up because nobody has my DNA. Mm-hmm. So those are problems right there. So, you know, that's one of the issues in law enforcement, too, you know. So,
well, and I think that, like I said, there's a lot of misleading information that is portrayed in various, although they use a lot of information that is accurate, but the technology, even though it's there, you're still dealing with people. And if a person has been murdered, that individual that has committed the crime, if they've got 5 cents worth of brains, they're not going to want to leave anything special around to be identified.
And
a lot of things are done on a random basis. You have a case here, Suzanne Linal. I may not be pronouncing her last name correctly. It's L Y.
Oh, Lyle, Suzanne Lyle, yeah.
Ann Lyle, okay. Spelled L Y A L L. She was white female. Her date of birth was April 6, 1978. She was 5'3". She is blonde, although in the picture here, she's just a delightful, delightful gal. She stepped off of a bus, and she hadn't been seen since. I mean, this is something where you go, wow, how do you trace that when you are in a city like New York? You have millions of people, hustle and bustle. Who would have even remembered her? Most of the people, I've ridden the buses, and they're busy. They're in their own little world. Why would someone notice her? Why would she stand out? Tell us about her.
Well, Suzanne Lyle, she was a student at the State University of Albany, up in Albany, and she was just your average. She was a good student. She was close with her family, and literally, she went to work that evening in the local mall, and she takes the bus back, and she, as you said, just stepped off the bus, and she's never been seen from again. Her parents knew right away that something was wrong because she had a habit of sending an email every night at 11 o'clock, and they did not get that email. So by the next morning, they had already been on the phone, you know, with the state university police. They'd gone to her room. She hadn't returned. And I'd like to say more about it, but she literally disappeared. The only thing that led them to believe that she might be alive is that 2 days after her disappearance, her ATM card was used at a local convenience store, and the PIN number had been put in first. The first time it was put in correctly, and the other time if somebody has taken the card, they don't know the PIN number, so they try a few times. But the PIN number was put in correctly, and the person only took $20 out of the account, which led them to believe it might be Suzanne. However, the store had cameras, and they've reviewed the cameras, and no one looking like Suzanne or remembering seeing her there, you know, she wasn't there. So they don't know who actually used her ATM card, but it was somebody who knew the PIN number or had gotten it from her. So, and literally, you know, it's like she was just taken off the planet. Now, there was a person who ID'd her getting off the bus. But the problem is the police say with ID and riding the bus, if you ride the bus all day, do you really know a few weeks later if that person got off the bus that Thursday or Friday? You know, so they weren't sure if they actually saw her getting off the bus on the night she disappeared or the night before. So, you know, they're not really sure if she made it back to her dorm on the bus, or if she perhaps was abducted outside the mall and did not get on the bus. Mm-hmm. The driver also, he's so used to her getting on the bus, he wasn't sure whether she got on the bus the night she was abducted or he remembered her from another night. So that's not 100% clear. So unfortunately, and I know her family very well. They have, they run the Center for Hope in Albany, New York, and they do some wonderful work with missing families. They've taken their grief and really turned it into helping other people find their loved ones.
Another segment in your book, Missing in New York, and this to me is fascinating, how the people that are trained to do this can get information off of the skeleton. They can determine with the skull, they can, with the body itself, they can reconstruct it. And you have a section in your book, John Doe's and Jane Doe's, where this has actually been done. And I think this is just such an incredible step forward. I don't remember if it was in the 70s when they finally, or 80s when they finally started accepting it. But these people that do this work are exceptionally talented. They are just amazing people and phenomenal artists. And there is a section in your book on individuals that they have found the remains, but they absolutely have no idea who the person is. And they, you have put a number of these photos in here, and maybe there will be someone somewhere that picks up the book, that they're going to be able to look at it, and they have been able to determine their ethnicity, and you know, to do that, to me, is just phenomenal. But
oh,
we've got, you know, different hair color, all kinds of things.
Yeah, I think it's just fascinating that, you know, from the skeleton, you can tell whether somebody was a male or a female. You can sometimes determine race. And what's, you know, what's interesting is that we'll, if they can put a face to it, put it out there again, it may jog somebody's memory. I hope you don't mind that I talk about Caledonia Jane, who is in there. She's a body that they found in Caledonia, New York. She's a young girl. She was somewhere between, they say, 14 and 18 years old. They don't mm-hmm. know who she was. She was found in the 70s, shot in a cornfield. She'd been shot in the back. And they didn't use the skeletal reconstruction because they actually found her right away, but they used, they've used digital to make her face look more natural because studies show when you show pictures of somebody who had passed away, a witness will tend not to look because they're disturbed by it. But if mm-hmm. they digitally reconstruct the face to look natural, people will stop a little while and look at her. And the reason I like to mention her is because she was at that age that somebody must have missed her somewhere in this country, you know. She must have been somebody's classmate. She must have, you know, gone out and it just disturbs me that you have this young girl that nobody seems to know, you know, had missed her. Because here she is in New York, you know, buried in an unmarked grave because we can't give her an identity.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing what they can do, you know, with the reconstruction. I actually went to Kristen Friedmorn's studio in Fort Edward, New York, and she showed me the whole process that they go through, and it's really a fascinating art. You know, it's art, it's intuition, it's skill, it's pretty amazing.
Right, and you also have an interesting chapter on search dogs. Now, I know we're coming close to running out of time, and you just have some wonderful suggestions in your books. You talk about a safe box. You talk about an ounce of prevention, what you need to do to keep things, and to make sure that if something like this happens, that there's enough information for the police to work with. And
yes.
I just think that this book, some might say, oh, who'd want to read about this? But I think you've got so much good information in it, Mariana. I really, really liked it. Gone Missing in New York is the book. And, Mariana, you have a blog. And this is something that people can go to. You don't have a website, but there's a blog. So if you know of anyone, those of you listening, that might be dealing with an issue like this. This is really a good book with some powerful information. GoneMissingInNewYork.com. GoneMissingInNewYork.com. And again, the information that she has in the book, she's focused on cases that are in New York, but a lot of the information she gives here goes across the board. I don't care where you are. This is something that could be extremely valuable. And for those of you that might have children, or you just want to have that ounce of prevention available, she's got some marvelous tips in here. And, Mariana, thank you very much for being my guest today. I think you've got a powerful book here. I think there's just so much that you cover. You've done an outstanding job. Thank you for being my guest today.
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break. We are going to be back in just a moment.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you.
We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Topperson will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Topperson. Topperson is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Topperson or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Topperson, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. With the Olympics and all of this sports activity going on, I thought I would share some information with you today about a game that maybe you've heard about, but you've never really been a part of, the game of cricket. Got some interesting information about that. The English absolutely love this game. But by the way, the phone lines are open, 888-627-6008. Well, John Barton King, this is a man that made history in the game of cricket. There are some people in the United States, they're called cricketers. Cool name. However, the top player that ever came from the U.S. was this man, Bart King. Now, what made him so absolutely amazing was his ability to dominate both as a bowler and as a batsman. And that's the equivalent when you compare it to American baseball, being a top-notch pitcher and a slugger. Well, he created a particular pitch that he called the angler, which dipped and swerved in a way that the people that were supposed to hit it didn't know what to do with it. And as a batter, he was one of the top scorers in North America. And he loved to talk. In fact, not only was he good at the game, but he was his own PR specialist. And the most famous story about him apparently comes from a 1901 match against a team from Trenton, New Jersey. And this is the legend that survives today. He was about to bowl to the Trenton team captain when the batter started to talk trash. Now, King said, "I don't like this stuff." And he remembered a stunt that he had seen in a baseball game. So he ordered the rest of the team, his team, off the field. And he thought, you know, I'm not going to need anybody to catch the ball because I'm going to strike out this loudmouth. It's just absolutely rude. Going to get fix this guy. Well, do you know what? It worked. It was a very brash move. Very gutsy. He fired off his angler pitch, and the Trenton captain, he struck out. He didn't make it at all. There are some people that have a talent, whether it's in sports or in other ways, that they excel at something, and they have a way of thinking and doing things that's outside the box. And when they do it, it befuddles the people around them. I think it's absolutely amazing. And it's also something that should make us feel, well, as I'm sure the people in the game did, that, woohoo, we took care of the sassy one, put them in their place. Anyway, I just thought I'd share that little bit of sports trivia with you. Telephone lines are open, 888-627-6008. Well, here in the Pacific Northwest, we have been having incredible weather, and it has been, if not 100 degrees, in certain areas, it's been over 100, and so this weekend was just absolutely amazing at the Rin Fair, and we've got two more weekends coming up, and I hope that you'll take the time. I've got one family pass left, one. So if you would like to have a family pass to the Renaissance Midsummer Fair, I would love to have you get it. Give me a call at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604. 5604, and I'll be glad to pop it off to you. And then also, just remember, when you come out to the fair, for those of you who are in Western Washington, make sure you bring an umbrella with you. Now, that's going to sound strange with the temps when they're really warm, but we're hoping it's going to be a little bit cooler. But when you're out in an environment where it's real intense sun, having an umbrella really insulates you from those sun rays, and it actually keeps you cooler. People in Asia have been doing this for hundreds of years. We should be smart enough to do it here. And I'll tell you, all of the vendors that had umbrellas at the fair, they sold out. They sold out because people were realizing how important it is. So if you have little ones you're going to bring out, make sure you cover them. Just don't let them be exposed to these intense rays, because I saw so many children that were getting burned. It just was just something that people don't realize how quickly the sun does affect you. And especially between noon and 4 o'clock, actually here, the most intensive part of the day is from about 2 until 6. And without cloud cover and without shade, you can get burned really, really quickly. This goes for anybody. When I used to travel to Hawaii, I learned from the Hawaiians real quickly, you stay out of the sun basically between noon and 5 o'clock because you are just going to be crisped. I'm telling you, I burn really, really fast, and you just want to be aware. Just be aware. Sunscreen will only work to a certain degree. After a certain amount of time, that sunscreen isn't really going to protect you. So you need to be wise enough to protect yourself no matter where you are. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. I've got a wonderful recipe that I wanted to share with you. Breaded chicken with lemon green onion tahini. Light. Wonderful for these hot days when you don't want heavy, heavy food. And it's just perfect. And with a light dessert, it's great. So get that pad of paper handy, and we're going to chat about that. I wanted to share a story with you, and it is talking about sun. It's about sun spheres. And when I came across this, I thought, piece of history. And as you know, if you listen to this show on a regular basis, you know how much I enjoy history. Well, on May 16th of 1808, there was an event that was recorded. And this was in Sweden, and it was all about the sun. And astrologically, there are so many things that can occur that people just, when the unusual happens, and that time frame, and even earlier, it was often considered the acts of gods. Either they liked you or they didn't like you. I mean, they come up with some kind of a story because they didn't know how to explain it. Well, this particular situation was a pretty tough one to explain. The sun actually went dim. And in the western horizon, there were literally millions of spheres of light that came out from the western horizon and traveled through the sky. And there was also a high wind. And people later said, well, maybe the wind blew something in. However, this is what occurred. When these balls of brilliant light went underneath the dim sun, the balls of light turned black. They seemed to stay in place like they were suspended in a time warp. And then they continued in a direct line before disappearing over the eastern horizon. There was no sound. And what some people noticed is that occasionally these balls of light would link up like a chain, and they seemed to be connected by a thin band. After they would separate, they would have tails. They called them impermanent tails. They were approximately 20 feet long. And sometimes the balls of light fell down to the earth. And there was a man whose name is K.G. Wettermark of the Swedish Academy. He he recorded what he saw, and he was so observant. He said they lost their dark color, and they became like soap bubbles. The rain, they were translucent, and you know how soap bubbles, when the light isn't, they'll have rainbows? Well, that is what he saw. And he said, then those that fell to the earth, he saw them, they dried up, and they disintegrated. Now, this unique phenomena went on for 2 hours. 2 hours. What was it? To this day, they don't know. In 1883, at an observatory in Mexico, Jose Bonilla photographed a tiny body followed by numerous others singly and also in groups of 20 crossing the sun. Now, this man was astute enough, he counted them. He counted 283 of these spherical bodies. And he said they appeared black against the sun, but throughout brilliant, brilliant trains of light. And the following morning, after this particular event, he recorded another 116 of the spheres. He believed that they were travelers. Now, this is in the 1800s. He said they were traveling in space near the Earth, but not so far as the moon. And then in Germany in 1880, at dawn, witnesses, number of people, saw spheres, luminous, not unlike those reported earlier in the 1800s, traveling across the sky from east to west. They were shining very brightly. In 1849, in Switzerland, thousands of radiant white snowflakes were suspended in the sky for about a half an hour. And you know what? As far back as 1566, large black globes were seen in the air, moving before the sun at great speed and turning against each other as if they were fighting. Some of them became red and fiery, and afterwards faded and went out. UFOs? I think that's what we'd call them today. As far back as 1566. Fascinating recorded history. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. This is Donna Siebel. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat at 888-627-6008. All right, I have this awesome recipe for this salad. It's really light, flavorful, and we're going to use some panko breadcrumbs, but I think what I'll do before I give out this information, I will take a break here. We'll be back in just a moment, and not only will I share with you a recipe, I'll share with you a wonderful story about a dog named Smokey Joe. We're going to be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Siebel. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007, that's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Donna Siebel publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. Bill Cosby is one of my favorite comedians. I just adore this man. And I loved a comment that he made. He said, a word to the wise ain't necessary. It's the stupid ones that need the advice. Couldn't pass that up. Great way to start off the week. All right. Quickly, too, I want to let you know who's going to be with us this week. We have a great lineup of guests. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Dale Cox. We're going to be talking about a true story, a top-secret flight. This was a piece of history I had no knowledge about, and it is relating to World War II. It is a fascinating story. And then we're going to be talking with Sean Mashore about the Bliss experiment. Bliss, can you experience it? Yes, you can. We'll find out how. The Gift of the Ladybug, Carol Amber is going to be my guest. And on Friday, we'll be talking with Marie Jones, and the book is titled, This Book is From the Future. Ooh, fascinating stuff. So I hope you can join me. All right, have you got that pad of paper and pen handy? Breaded chicken with lemon green onion tahini. Now, this is going to call for some panko breadcrumbs. And dependent on who you are and what works for your diet, panko is wonderful too because it's nice and light. But here we go. It's real simple and easy. A quarter of a cup of tahini. You're going to need 2 tablespoons plus 1 teaspoon of fresh lemon juice. Fresh is best with this recipe. 3 scallions, finely chopped. And if you don't like raw onions, you can eliminate those. I'm one. I don't go along with raw onions very well. So for me, that would be out of the recipe. But the recipe is delicious regardless. So you can keep them on the side if you want. Salt and freshly ground pepper. You're going to need 4 boneless, skinless chicken breast halves. They're going to be about 6 ounces each. 1 egg, 2 teaspoons of Dijon mustard, 1 teaspoon of grated lemon zest. Again, in this recipe, fresh is best. 1 cup of panko breadcrumbs and 3 tablespoons of olive oil, or you may need a little bit more. Keep some handy. And you're going to need 6 ounces of baby spinach, washed and ready to go. And what you want to do, this is how simple it is, in a small bowl, you mix your tahini with your 2 tablespoons of lemon juice, and then mix in 2 tablespoons of hot water. You want the texture to be about that of thick mayonnaise, so mix it accordingly. If you need more water, fine. Now, you can put the onions in this mixture if you like, and season with salt and pepper. If you don't want onions in the tahini, you can put them on the side. Let people help themselves. Now, your chicken breast halves, you want to put each breast half between 2 sheets of wax paper, and you want to pound them until they're 1/2 inch in thickness. Now, then in a bowl, you're going to combine your egg, your mustard, your lemon zest, and if you want, scallions, and add your chicken, turn it to coat, sprinkle the chicken with salt and pepper, and in a pie or cake pan, you want to have your panko ready to go. And then in a large nonstick skillet over medium-high heat, you put in 2 tablespoons of oil. You dip your chicken breast, your pounded chicken breast, in the panko, turning to coat it on both sides. Put it in the pan. And depending on the size of your pan, you may have to cook the chicken in batches. It's okay. And cook it until it's browned and cooked through, 4 to 5, maybe 6 minutes per side, adding oil as needed. Now, with your spinach, while your chicken's cooking, you're going to add 1 tablespoon of oil. You toss the spinach leaves. Then, and if you want, add a little bit of salt and pepper. Add in 1 teaspoon of lemon juice. Divide your spinach among 4 plates because this is for 4 servings. You slice your chicken once you've cooked it, put it on top of the spinach, and spoon your tahini sauce over the chicken, and you serve it right away. Fast, easy, light, and flavorful. Just really, really good. On those hot days, I don't know if you're like me, but the last thing you want is heavy, heavy-duty food. You want something that's light and easy to digest. Oh, and let's see, what else? Oh, I can't remember what I was going to tell you, but let me get to Smokey Jill. I have a real soft spot in my heart for animals, and when someone is running a ranch or a farm, animals, you have maybe a different attitude about them because many times this is, I mean, life is hard on a farm and on a ranch. And your animals, you often develop a different perspective with. Well, Smokey Joe is a very special dog. And Susan Stone lives in Wyoming. And she needed to have a dog to help her on the ranch. Anybody that has large areas of property knows how important a dog is. and you want a particular kind of dog. Well, Australian Shepherds are fabulous, fabulous dogs, and they're wonderful herders. And she had been told by someone that they had this new litter of pups, and it was an Australian Shepherd and Border Collie mix. And when she went to see this litter, one of the puppies literally jumped into her lap. This puppy was wanting to go with Susan. And I find it amazing when dogs do this. It's happened with me, with some of our Scotties. They choose you. It's an amazing experience. If you haven't had it, one day I hope you do, because it's just unbelievable. Well, that's what happened with her. And he just automatically, that's it. She was the person he wanted to be with. Well, she called him Smokey Joe because one of her favorite singers was Smokey Robinson, the country singer. And she said, oh, his coat looks smoky. It just suited him. Well, this dog, as a puppy, that afternoon that she got him, instantly was learning command. He was responding to her. He had mastered within a few months commands verbally and by hand, started working with her sheep on her ranch. By the time he was 9 months old, he was operating full time on her ranch. He was doing stuff the way he was supposed to. He was loyal and he was obedient. He would listen to her every word. She was so grateful for him. She never thought she was going to have this kind of a dog. Now, when he was about 4 years old, Smokey went with her everywhere. When he was about 4 years old, she was working on someone else's ranch. And she said, cows with newborn calves, they don't want dogs around. The cows will just kill a dog if they can. And she never allowed Smokey, because she was on this other ranch, to come in with her, to be around her when she was working with calves. Well, Susan got into a situation where a cow with a newborn calf charged her. And she really, Susan was just having a terrible time. And it was really, really getting bad. And she had to be very careful. So she had told Smokey to stay out of the area she was working in. There was this newborn calf. The heifer started going ballistic. And she just mauled Susan. And it was unbelievable. The mother was upset. Well, anybody that's worked around animals, you know, a mother and a calf, you don't want to get in between them. Well, she was really bad, but you know what? This was the one time Smokey Joe disobeyed her. He went after the cow, biting her on the face and ears. She tried to trample him, but he would not give up. He managed to get the cow back into a shed area. She was terrified of him. Got her back in and made sure that Susan was able to get out. As it turned out, she ended up spending 4 days in intensive care. And she said, this dog was thinking, figuring things out. Saved her life. Wonderful story, Smokey Joe. This is Donna Siebel. We're out of time. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Look forward to having you join me again tomorrow. Tell your friends. This is Donna Siebel. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.